the trial of Karen Reed for the death of her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, is underway.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
The first week of testimony has come to an end.
It's a spectacle. That's for sure.
We really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
The fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that.
Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
It's always the theories or stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
We asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
When the FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder, that never, ever happens.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Defense attorneys learn in school, first class, the most important thing you can do is identify and select stupid juries.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
In the previous episode, we wrapped up the first 12 days of trial. On day 13, following the testimony of Colin Albert, Matt McCabe was called to the stand, and his testimony continued into day 14. His wife, Jen McCabe, was called after him, and her testimony was spread out over the course of 3 days. We then heard from Carrie Roberts, followed by the Sullivan sisters, who were in Aruba and testified to an argument between John and Karen while they were there, and then Brian Higgins. So there's a lot to cover. Let's just jump right in. Matt McCabe, Jen McCabe, and Brian Higgins are the last three witnesses from the waterfall that we expect to hear from during this trial. A lot of the information is the same. Everyone was happy, in good spirits, no fighting. Nobody seemed overly intoxicated. There was a band. They sat at high-top tables, etc., etc., etc. Same things over and over. Let's get to the stuff that actually stood out about their testimony. Jen McCabe gave some background about her relationship to John O'Keefe and Karen Reed. She said that John was her friend and she loved him, and she said that she enjoyed Karen. They connected from the beginning and she was easy to talk to. They both have MS and there aren't a lot of people their age that have it, so she said that it was nice to have someone who understood what she was going through since they have that in common. One thing I noticed the entire time that Jen was testifying, she tended to look over and address the jury directly, especially on things that seemed important to her, things that she definitely wanted the jury to know. She did this more often than any other witness has. Another thing that I noticed is that there were a few things that she said during her testimony that directly mirrored previous testimony from other members of her family or other witnesses. For example, that sweet moment that the court had when everyone kind of chuckled as Paul O'Keefe said that Kaylee is embarrassed by John's convertible. She said something very similar, but it didn't have the same effect. It wasn't one of the things where everybody stopped and laughed, but she said almost the same thing. When she was asked about talking to her family about the case, she also gave almost the exact same answer as a previous witness when referencing talking about the case versus talking about being harassed, and we'll get into more of that later. And also, when she was asked about seeing something in the yard, she gave the same answer as Matt McCabe and Brian Albert. Quote, I wish I had, end quote. That doesn't necessarily mean that she's listening or watching what's going on, but it probably means that they've at least talked about this pretty often or recently. Testimony about what happened while at Waterfall was overall consistent with everything else that we've heard from everyone else who was there. We heard early on from Karina Kolokithis that there was a conversation at Waterfall where Karen was saying that she wished some of John's family would step up and help out with the kids more, and that she wished she could get more alone time with John. While on the stand, Jen McCabe references that conversation as well.
Karen had shared a little bit of frustration that morning. Or one morning she had taken Kaylee to Dunkin' Donuts and John, you know, was frustrated, didn't, you know, saying, don't take her. She's going to, you know, make a habit of it, meaning like she's going to come to expect it every day. And then we just talked about how, you know, challenging it is with kids. And, you know, she mentioned that that's kind of all they have a fight about. And I said, yeah, well, welcome to parenthood, you know. And, you know, she just was a little bit frustrated. Felt like the family needed to be doing more to help, and she just wished she had, you know, more time, just her and John. But again, it was just, you know, girlfriend to girlfriend kind of venting.
Another moment that was brought up again is the video footage of Brian Higgins and Brian Albert, where they're doing some type of boxing and wrestling moves on each other. Yannetti asks Matt McCabe about this, and it makes for a really awkward court moment.
Did you see Brian Albert and Brian Higgins practicing fighting at the Waterfall?
Practicing fighting?
Right. Did you see them kind of square up in a fighting stance to each other?
I recall them grabbing each other. I don't recall them squaring up like they were fighting each other. No, they were playing a little grab ass with each other. I did see them grab each other. I don't recall a physical, hey, let's go duke it out. I do not recall that.
Okay, so are you saying, taking you literally, that they grabbed each other's asses? Is that it?
No, I'm saying grab ass. It's a figure speech.
Okay, but what they didn't grab each other. They were in a fighting stance, weren't they? Didn't they crouch down low with each other?
I'm telling you, I don't recall seeing them crouching in a fighting stance. I recall someone grabbing somebody. I don't remember who grabbed who. I just recall like a bear hug or something. I recall them doing a bear hug.
All right.
Jen said that when they were getting ready to leave the bar, she told John and Karen that they should come to the Alberts' house, and she said that they agreed. Matt stayed inside talking to the band for a moment when they went outside, so she said that she told Karen that she should just ride with her. During cross-examination, attorney Alan Jackson pushes on this, asking Jen if she was trying to separate Karen from John. Jen maintains that she wasn't intentionally trying to separate them for any reason. She looks directly at the jury and says, it was innocent. Jen and Matt headed toward Fairview, and Jen had a conversation with John on the way there. Matt heard it as well since it picked up in the car's Bluetooth, and Jen told him the address and directions on how to get there, explaining that he should turn from Chapman onto Fairview, and referenced Bella's house, one of Kaylee's friends. Jen also brings up that John actually dated Bella's mom briefly years before. When they got to the house, Jen and Matt parked in the driveway on the left side, and there was another car in front of them. Matt said that Brian Higgins' Jeep with the snowplow was parked right in front of the mailbox to the left of the driveway. Matt and Jen said that they never saw Colin at the house when they arrived. They didn't see their daughter Allie, who had come to pick Colin up, and they never saw John O'Keefe enter the house. They listed off the names of the people who were there, and Jen mentions that she knows Julie Nagel pretty well. Julie had actually dog sat for them before, so she offered to give her a ride home if she didn't want to go with her brother Ryan. Ryan arrived at some point and was parked outside in Ricky D'Antano's truck. Matt said that he didn't really pay too close attention to the truck. His focus was only on the SUV. He knew that the truck was out there, but for whatever reason was only focused on the SUV. He did say that the Jeep was still parked right there in front of the mailbox, despite everyone in the truck saying that there was no Jeep there. Ryan Nagel, Ricky D'Antano, and Heather Maxson were all very clear that there was no Jeep parked in front of them. They were looking directly at the back of Karen Reed's SUV. But that's not what Matt and Jen McCabe are saying.
You saw that black SUV parked outside the Albert home. Higgins' Jeep was still there, correct?
Yes, to my recollection, the Jeep was still outside in front of the mailbox.
The black SUV was parked in front of Higgins' Jeep with the plow on the front, correct?
That's correct.
Jen McCabe also said that the Jeep was parked in front of the mailbox. When Alan Jackson questioned her about this on Cross, he brought up that Matt had said the same thing about the location of the Jeep, despite it being directly contradictory to what everyone else has said. There was a moment during this questioning that has been interpreted in different ways. Some people think that Jen was just confused on the question, and some people think that she accidentally slipped up and admitted to watching the testimony that she's not supposed to be watching before she testifies.
I'm not sure if I said, whose Jeep is that?
No, I don't mean then. I mean, between then and now, have you and Mr. McCabe ever discussed where that Jeep was, your memories of where that Jeep was?
Possibly.
You're aware that he put the Jeep in the exact same place that you did.
Objection.
Are you aware of that?
I am. Oh, wait, no, excuse me. Repeat the question.
You're aware that he puts the Jeep in the exact same spot you just put the Jeep, right in front of that mailbox, right?
I know he knows where the Jeep was. I'm not aware what he said in here.
Does he know where the Jeep was because you told him what to say about the Jeep?
Absolutely not. It's because we drove together in the car, and I asked. I possibly could have asked.
One at a time, please, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on your words. I thought you...
That's okay. You can continue.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Definitely no love lost between Alan Jackson and Jen McCabe. Jackson asked Jen why the Jeep being parked there is not in any of the reports, especially since Proctor asked her open-ended questions. The interviews from law enforcement are different than the questioning in a courtroom. These aren't just yes or no answers. These are open-ended questions to get as much information as possible to give the full picture or the full story. So why is this big detail not in any of the reports? Jen asked to refresh her memory, and after looking at the report from her interview with Trooper Proctor, she said that that's not what she told Trooper Proctor. This exchange doesn't end there. Again, when Alan Jackson questions Jen McCabe about what she told Proctor or what she remembers, she asks to see the report. Jackson tells her, "I'm asking for your memory. You're testifying." Jen says that Proctor was also wrong about where she said the SUV was parked. She said that she 100% told him that it was parked straight out the front door. That directly contradicts Proctor's report, which says that Jen said that the SUV pulled up and parked where she's now testifying that the Jeep was. Jen goes on to say that she's not positive where the truck was when Ryan Nagel pulled up, but she knows for sure that the Jeep would have been parked in between the truck and the SUV. Jackson also brings up that during her entire grand jury testimony, Jen never mentioned the Jeep being parked there when she's discussing the cars out front or seeing Karen's SUV or Ryan Nagel's truck. Jen says that she may not have been asked about it. Jackson asked Jen if she has talked to Higgins or has been told by anyone to make sure to mention his Jeep being parked there. She says, "Not that I recall, no." This is such a crazy thing for me to try to understand. She and Matt McCabe are both so sure about this, but the individuals in the truck who were parked right there are so sure about the opposite being true, that there was no Jeep in front of them. Nicole Albert vaguely remembers the Jeep being parked there, and Higgins testified that he parked there, but the three who pulled up are positive that it was not there, and nobody else remembers seeing it parked there. One more thing in this case that just doesn't seem to make much sense at this point. Jen testified to the grand jury that Ryan Nagel was out front at 12:23. This time was based on her asking Julie Nagel for the screenshots of her text with her brother when he had arrived. She also testified that as soon as she saw Karen's SUV, she texted John, which was at 12:27. Alan Jackson points out that this would mean that there are 4 minutes where Karen would have been outside before Jen saw the car. I also want to pause for a moment and mention something random that stood out to me here. when Lally was asking Jen about what kind of car John had and what Karen had, Jen referred to Karen's Lexus as a, quote, small SUV, end quote. But Karen had a Lexus LX 570. That's a full-size, large SUV. If I'm the defense attorney, I think that I would make note of that. Could she be referring to it as a small SUV because Lucky the snowplow driver referenced seeing a Ford Edge, which is a small SUV, parked by where John's body was found? It could also mean absolutely nothing. But the devil's in the details, so I try to make note of them when I can. Jen said that Karen's SUV was running when she looked outside and the lights were on. She sent that first text at 12:27 but didn't get a response. At 12:31, Jen said that she saw the car had moved from the prior spot in front of the house over toward the flagpole, and she didn't know what they were doing, so she sent another text to pull behind her car. She sent another text at 12:40, but isn't sure if the car was gone or not by that point. She said that while she's sending these texts, she had gone to the front door and then sat back down, got up again, and then saw the car had moved, went back and looked out again, basically kind of back and forth. She sends a few more texts at 12:42 and 12:45, and she also showed some calls to John's phone around this time. There's one call on the report from 12:29 a.m. from Jen to John O'Keefe that shows as answered, but also shows as deleted from Jen's phone. Jen said that she didn't talk to John at this time, though, and she tells Jackson that there are 20 calls that are showing as deleted, and she feels like he is cherry-picking certain ones. Jen says that she voluntarily handed over her phone to the police, and she asked if she could delete her calls to her daughters before turning it over, and they said that's fine. She doesn't recall deleting anything else on her phone. Jackson brings up the number of calls that she placed to John that night and asks her, "Have you ever misplaced your phone?" Jen says, "Yeah," and when she does, she has someone call it. Jackson points out that you can call a phone that many times if it's misplaced and you're looking for it as a clear indication that if John O'Keefe did enter the house and they were looking for his phone, then maybe they called it that many times trying to find it. Jackson also brings up Jen's previous testimony where she tells a grand jury that she has another explanation for these calls.
At this other proceeding, mm-hmm. which were under oath.
Yes.
Right? You explained that these calls were what? These missed calls, incessant missed calls. What were they? You used a word. I'd like two words.
I believe I used the word butt dials.
You claimed that every one of these calls was a butt dial. Is that right?
Yes.
So according to you, you literally butt dialed John O'Keefe's phone 6 times in the span of 19 minutes. Is that right?
I don't remember making any of those calls, so my assumption is I put my phone in my back pocket, and that was it.
So here we are with more butt dials. 6 or 7 calls in a short period of time, none that go to voicemail, are explained by Jen McCabe as butt dials. The call from Brian Albert to Brian Higgins at 2:22 a.m. was explained as a butt dial. And the call back from Brian Higgins to Brian Albert was also explained as a butt dial. Canton, Massachusetts has the busiest butts I've ever seen in a single trial. During cross-examination, David Unetti and Matt McCabe go back and forth as Unetti tries to nail down what has been said in previous reports about where he saw the SUV and about the Jeep being parked by the mailbox. Proctor's report says that Matt McCabe saw the SUV at the right side of the property when he first looked out the window, but the second time he looked out, it had moved about 15 or 20 feet. On the stand, Matt is saying that the SUV was directly in front of the house when he first saw it, not on the right side of the property. They go back and forth for a bit, with Unetti trying to clear up if Matt has changed his recollection or if this is another report that they are saying is wrong. The moment got pretty tense.
You deny telling Michael Proctor that when you first saw the SUV, by the way, sir, is this funny? I'm sorry.
This is not funny, sir. Not at all. It's been 2 years of misery. Okay.
You're smiling now. That's why I ask.
You keep repeating the same question.
Well, I'm trying to get an answer that you won't give me, sir.
Matt also mentioned seeing tire tracks in the street, and Yannetti questions him about this.
That black SUV first arrived, you noticed that there were tire tracks, I should say, in a V shape on the street in front of the Albert home, correct?
That's correct.
And those tire tracks were from the curb in front of 34 Fairview toward the neighbor's property across the street and then back toward the curb, correct?
Yes, it came out, waved out towards to the cross the street and came back in.
All right. And the pattern of those tire tracks that you observed were consistent with the vehicle making a three-point turn, correct?
Objection.
Can you answer that?
I don't know if the vehicle made a three-point turn. It could be consistent with because it was a wavy pattern. Okay. I've never looked at a tire tracks after I've done a three-point turn to determine what they actually look like, but in and back out.
There was nothing about those tire tracks that ruled out a three-point turn to you, correct?
No.
All right.
Yannetti brings up the conversation that Matt McCabe overheard of Jen giving John directions to the house as it relates to Bella's house, one of Kaylee's friends, and telling him to turn onto Fairview from Chapman, which would have him coming from the south. Yannetti asked Matt if the reason that he said he saw tire tracks consistent with a three-point turn are because he thought that Karen would be coming from that direction. So in order to face the way that he saw her car facing, she would have had to have made a three-point turn. Matt isn't sure. The three-point turn tire tracks have always been confusing because every bit of information that we have suggests that Karen turned onto Fairview from the north end, we know that, and drove off in the direction she came. Jen McCabe also mentions tire tracks in her testimony, though it wasn't in the reports from her interviews. When she describes them, she says that she saw them one of the times that she looked outside, but they were in a wave-type motion. Jackson asked Jen about her clear view of the SUV, her clear line of vision, her ability to see the tracks, and asks how, if she were able to see all of that, she somehow didn't see John O'Keefe in the yard if he had been hit. Jen then repeats the same line that we heard from Brian Albert and Matt McCabe.
After that SUV was gone, and you looked out that window with that clear and good view, there was no body, was there?
I never saw a body.
Thank you.
I wish I had.
Sounds like that's a little rehearsed.
Not at all.
We'll be right back. Jen said that when Karen and John never came inside, she assumed that they had either gotten into a fight or maybe Kaylee had called and wanted him home, so they left. Matt and Jen left Fairview Road, taking Julie Nagel and Sarah Levinson both home. Neither Matt nor Jen heard Julie Nagel say anything about a black object or a black blob, despite Jen saying that she was turned around in her seat facing them to talk to them. And neither Matt nor Jen saw anything in the yard. When they got home, Jen and Matt both recalled the exact same details of what they did on that night 2.5 years ago. They both mentioned Jen wanting to watch a show and Matt didn't want to. Matt made a snack with some cheese or something because of his diet competition. And then they both mentioned Jen talking about basketball and researching a basketball team on her phone before going to sleep. Hence explaining the 2:27 a.m. search for how long to die in the cold really being a search for a basketball team. Alan Jackson waits until the end of day 3, the very end of her cross-examination, to ask her about the Google search. And again, the exchange between them gets heated.
Did you, in fact, use a phrase to Google search how long it takes for someone to die of extreme temperatures?
I did in the morning at the request of your client.
Okay. And what phrase did you use?
I'm not sure.
Really?
Correct. I was...
After 2.5 years of this, you don't know the phrase that you used?
Objection, Your Honor.
There's so many lies and misconceptions on social media.
No question.
Oh, I apologize.
Okay. Are you telling me you don't remember what Google search you put in?
Karen was screaming,
My hands were shaking, and she was saying, Google hypothermia, how long does it take to die in the cold?
And what phrase did you put in your phone? I'm just asking you to say it.
Why don't you show me it?
You literally don't remember?
Again, she was screaming, Google hypothermia, how long does it take to die in the cold?
How about?
And I picked up my phone, and I started Googling.
And you literally, to this day, right now, under oath, you're saying you don't remember that phrase that you used.
Objection.
I'll allow it.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that at her...
Do you remember it or do you not, Ms. McCabe? That's a simple question.
That morning, I don't remember specifically what I Googled, but I do know what you've put out to the social media.
How about this? Hoss long to die in cold. That sound familiar?
Yeah, it's been everywhere.
Why does that sound so familiar?
Because you've put it out in social media.
Well, I haven't put anything out in social media because I don't personally have social media.
I'm sorry, Turtle Boy did.
So if the world happens to know it, that's not on me, is it?
I guess not.
I guess not.
Jackson shows the jury the report that shows that the search with the specific misspelling of how as H-O-S was done at 2:27 a.m., then there was a search done with a different spelling at 6:23 a.m., and then the same spelling with the HOS was done again at 6:24 a.m. He asked Jen if she made that search at 2:27 because she knew that John O'Keefe was outside on her sister's lawn dying in the cold. He says the next morning, the search was done again to cover up the incriminating search, basically to cover her tracks. He also points out the column that shows that the 227 search was deleted and asks why that's the only one of them that was deleted. Jen said that she would not have left John out there because he was her friend. Jackson replied, but he's not your family, is he? When Lally gets up to address this on redirect, he brings up this 227 a.m. search, and although nobody in this trial seems to recall some of the major things that have remained unanswered, somehow, Jen McCabe remembers that when she was searching things, laying in bed at almost 2:30 a.m. after a night out of drinking, she somehow remembers that she turned off her phone and did not close out the tab that she was searching Ozone Basketball on. I know that the Commonwealth is going to explain the 227 search by using the open tabs being later closed as the checkpoint that writes that search onto the database. So they need this to be true in order to explain that. And look, it may be true, but is it really believable that she actually remembers such a random and insignificant detail? The jury will have to decide what they think. The prosecution and the defense will both have digital experts up there to explain this search. The prosecution's experts will say that it happened after 6 a.m. The defense's experts will say that it also happened at 2:27 a.m. The experts that I talked to explained how the coding works and said that it wouldn't show up at 2:27 if it was only done at 6:24. But that's based on how the program code is written, not on the actual forensic download of the phone. The jury will hear both experts and hear all about the forensic download of the phone and once again have to decide what they believe is plausible. The Google search, for me, was the very first thing that made me step back and look at this case in a way that made me think, something doesn't really sound right. And the data extractions from the phones are trusted in every other trial, so what reason would we have to think that this situation is any different? If the search had been done on Karen's phone at 2:27 a.m. and her defense attorneys were the ones trying to convince a jury that it wasn't really done at 2:27, do you think that the jury would believe that? Probably not. This does not mean that Jen McCabe is guilty of anything, but it provides a level of reasonable doubt that could make a jury really question things. The next morning, Jen said that she woke up to a phone call from Kaylee, John's niece, saying that John didn't come home and Karen wanted to talk to her. Karen was screaming in the background, and Matt said it was so loud that it woke him up as well.
I awoke to the screaming of, Jen, Jen, Jen. So when I woke up, I thought there was somebody in my bedroom. I kind of snapped up out of bed. What the hell's going on? Looking around the room. Realized my wife was actually on the phone.
Jen recalls her conversation with Karen.
She proceeds to scream my name multiple times, and she tells me that John didn't come home, they got into a fight, and that she left him at the waterfall.
And how do you respond to that?
I had just woken up. I was confused. I didn't know what she was talking about. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And then she, you know, told me that they had gotten into a fight and she left him there. And now where is he? And she was just kept screaming my name over and over. And so then I remembered that Chris Albert had still been at the bar. So I thought, well, maybe John walked home with Chris because Chris lives close to the waterfall.
Jen said that she hung up with Karen and called Julie to see if John was with Chris. In the meantime, she told Matt that Karen couldn't find John. She left him at the waterfall. Matt said, "What are you talking about? We saw them outside of your sister's house."
I thought she was crazy.
And why was it?
Because I saw her vehicle. I saw the black SUV arrive to the 34 Fairview that morning.
Matt also heard Jen on the phone that night before, giving directions to John when he and Karen were on the way. So he said that he knew Karen hadn't left him at Waterfall. When Jen got in touch with Karen again and told her that they had seen them outside the house, she said that Karen said she didn't even remember going there. Jen said that Karen told her that they had gotten into a fight and she left him there. And she said that Karen was basically extremely irrational, talking crazy, and hard to understand. One part of the story that we are hearing now for the first time is that Karen mentioned a cracked taillight while on the phone with Jen that morning. The statement of case says that Karen didn't mention it until she was with Jen, and the PCA and the interview with Jen McCabe from February 1st both also say that Karen brought this up when they were in the car. But here on the stand, we hear a different version of the story from both Jen McCabe and her husband.
She told me that she didn't remember going there, and then she started yelling, Jen, and then she was saying, "Did I hit him? Could I have hit him?" And then she proceeded to say that she had a cracked taillight.
Jen said that she started thinking about other places near Fairview that John could be, and she thought about a friend of John's named Tom Betty, who she called as well. Jen decided that they needed to go look for him, so she said that she went downstairs to make a coffee, Matt was getting dressed, and then all of a sudden they hear screaming out front.
While I was getting dressed, I put my jeans on, my wife went downstairs, she was going to make a coffee. My wife and I were proceeding to leave. We were going to leave our house and make a drive to the house of the gentleman that my wife was calling that we possibly thought John could have met up with. And within that moment, again, I don't know the exact time, I then heard yelling out in my front yard.
And when you heard the yelling in your front yard, what did you do?
I realized it was Karen Reed, and I told my wife to please tell her to shut up. She's going to wake up the whole neighborhood.
Two things stood out to me right here. Number one, if she was screaming loud enough to wake up the whole neighborhood, and she was also screaming like this outside of Fairview Road, how did she not wake up Brian and Nicole Albert? And number two, this is another new version of events for us. This is the first time that we've heard that Karen just showed up. According to her interview from January 29th, Jen told Karen to come to her house and that they would go look for John together. So once again, it's a new version of events that we're hearing. While they were in the yard, Carrie Roberts pulled up. Jen said that she decided that they needed to go to John's house. Maybe he was there, passed out, and she just didn't see him. So she said that she drove Karen's car since Karen was too hysterical to drive, and Carrie followed behind them. Jen said that Carrie called Karen while they were on the way to John's, and Karen was screaming, "Could I have hit him? Did I hit him?" and saying that she cracked her taillight, and said that they needed to go to Fairview Road. Jen said that Carrie was telling her to shut up, and they just needed to go back to John's. When they pulled into John's driveway, Jen said that Karen pulled them to the back of the car and showed them the taillight being cracked. We saw the video and this didn't happen when they first got there, so the timing may be off. We're not exactly sure when that happened. Jen said that she saw that there were missing pieces on the taillight, but there was snow covering it and she didn't stare in depth. She just knows that there was missing pieces. Jen said that Carrie was yelling at Karen, telling her that she's driving around drunk and that she could have hit anything. Jen said that the right side garage door was open and they went inside. They bring up again how meticulous John O'Keefe kept his home, and when they entered, Lally made a point to ask about Jen and Carrie taking off their shoes at the door while Karen just ran straight in the house. This is a weird detail to me because if I'm in panic mode and I'm scared and screaming the way that they said Karen was, I'm not going to be thinking about taking off my shoes either. But Lally references this as being a quote-unquote rule in John's home. As they go through and look around John's, Jen noticed the bed was made, and we hear that Karen slept on the couch waiting for him to come home. Jen says that Karen kept screaming that they need to go to Fairview, so they got in Carrie's car and left. On the way there, Jen said that Karen was sitting in the back and leaned up between her and Carrie, just screaming, "Carrie, Carrie," just her name over and over, and Jen's name over and over, and just repeating certain phrases, like, "Could I have hit him? Did I hit him?" Carrie was apparently yelling at her to shut up and sit back and to buckle up and look for John. She said that Karen was screaming. He didn't come home. Could he be walking home? Where is he? And then she starts to list off different people's houses that he may be at. At one point, Jen said that Karen asked if John could be at Bella's, the friend who lived nearby that they referenced when giving directions the night before. Now, during this part of the testimony, it seems like the prosecution is wanting to paint the picture that this is an example of Karen acting crazy and jealous, but personally, I think that it could easily be interpreted as trying to find him, since it was just mentioned that Bella lived nearby the night before. Jen said that Karen was spiraling and that she thought that asking about John being at Bella's was irrational, but if she doesn't know where he is and she thinks that she dropped him off, and they're saying that he didn't come in, wouldn't it be a rational thought to think that he could be at someone else's house nearby? Jen said that Carrie was screaming at Karen to sit back, and sometimes she would sit back and almost be quiet for a minute, and then it would start all over again. Jen said that they passed the flagpole area, and then all of a sudden Karen started screaming, there he is," and banging to get out of the car. Carrie unlocked the door, and Karen got out. Jen said that Carrie looked at her and said that Karen was batshit crazy. When she discusses this with attorney Alan Jackson, you can hear the anger and accusation in her voice.
So I'm not really sure how she saw John over here when her head is up here screaming and then looking down and texting.
Was the whole point of that trip, Ms. McCabe, to search for John?
It was, because she knew where he was.
The whole point of that trip was to look for him, correct?
She directed us to go to 34 Fairview.
The whole point of the trip was to look for John, correct?
At 34 Fairview, where Karen said to go.
And your testimony is that if it hadn't been for Karen jumping out of that truck, you wouldn't have stopped, correct?
Because I wouldn't have seen him. I didn't know he was there. She did.
Yes or no? Was that your statement? If she hadn't gotten out of the car, you wouldn't have stopped.
I don't believe it was stated like that. I believe there was a question and I answered.
And the question was, would you have stopped? And your answer was what?
What was the direct question?
Oh my goodness, Ms. McCabe. It was 5 minutes ago.
Right. Did he ask, did you see something? You like to change words. I just want to be certain.
So, Mr. Jackson, just keep it to questions, not comments.
You were asked just a second ago by Mr. Lally, if Karen Reed had jumped out of the car, you wouldn't have stopped, correct?
Correct.
When Karen ran over to John, she straddled him, lifting her shirt and his, laying on him, trying to warm him up, while Carrie wiped the snow from his face. Jen said that she got out of the car and for a second or two just completely froze. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. She said that she and Carrie made eye contact, and then she called 911. Carrie asked her to get blankets or towels out of the back of her car, so she runs them over there, and Carrie kind of lifted John up, putting the blankets underneath him, screaming at Karen to get off of him. They yelled back and forth, and she said that Karen was screaming, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" Jen walks over to the car while calling 911 because she said that they were so loud. Karen and Carrie were yelling about doing CPR, and when Karen began to do mouth-to-mouth, blood started coming from John O'Keefe's mouth. Officers began to arrive, and Karen is still running around screaming. When the EMT arrived and asked what happened, Jen said that Karen was still screaming, "Is he dead? Could I have done this?" And she says something that we've never heard from Jen McCabe before, that she heard Karen say, "I hit him."
One EMT had asked, you know, his name, his age, things like that, if she knew what happened. Ms. Reed stated that she hit him. Besides running around saying, "I hit him, did I hit him, could I have done this, is he dead, is he dead?" At one point, one of the police officers put Ms. Reed in the back of her cruiser, and he asked for myself to go over with her, and Carrie came over with us as well.
I'd like to just take you back to when the paramedic is asking for information, biographical information, things like that. You indicated that the defendant said, "I hit him," is that correct?
Yes.
That's something that you said once or more than once?
Three times. I hit him, I hit him, I hit him.
Now, before you had made reference to statements she made with sort of qualifiers or questions as far as could I have hit him or did I hit him, is that what she said at that time when she was speaking to the paramedic?
No, she was earlier, it was could I, did I. When she spoke to the paramedic, it was crystal clear, I hit him.
This is something that Alan Jackson points out during cross. Jen says that she reviewed her grand jury testimony from April of 2022 in preparation for trial. Jackson gives her a copy of her transcript, more than 200 pages, and asks her to turn to the page where she has said that before.
Ms. McCabe, I'd like you to turn to the page since you've reviewed this. Turn to the page of that document where you ever said in your testimony that my client said, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him."
Was I asked what she said?
I get to ask the questions.
Well, I'd like you to direct me where to look.
I want you to look at the entire grand jury testimony if you need to, and turn to the page where you ever said that my client said, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him."
I'm not sure if it's in this document, but I can tell you today with 100% clarity, she said, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," on that morning.
So it's not in that document, is it?
I'm not sure if I could take the time, and do you want me to read to over 200 pages?
No, I don't want to take the time. Because you just indicated that you reviewed this document in anticipation of the testimony, right?
Correct.
So you've gone over it recently?
A few weeks back.
So we don't need to read it. You know that you never testified to that in the grand jury in April of 2022, don't you?
I don't know that as a fact. I would have to reread 222 pages, or however long it is.
You think you might have missed it when you reviewed your testimony? When you reviewed your transcript in anticipation for your testimony?
Objection.
Hello.
I read it a few weeks ago.
It's probably the most powerful part of your testimony, ma'am.
And I will never forget it.
Objection.
Okay, so that's stricken.
Would you agree? Do you think that's a powerful part of your testimony?
Objection.
I'll allow that.
It is, yes.
Did you see it in the transcript?
I cannot recall. It's over 200 pages.
Jackson points out that Jen was asked no fewer than 12 times what Karen said either at the scene or on the way to the scene. And every time, in 12 separate statements, she said that Karen asked, "Did I hit him?" but never mentioned her saying, "I hit him." He goes through each page where she testified to this being a question, including the specific time that she testified about when Karen said in front of the EMT, and points out that she never said that Karen said it as a statement. Jen insists that she told Link about this and that that's just another one of the reports that she says must be wrong. We'll be right back. When Jen is testifying, she gives information on the Google search and why she says that she searched How Long to Die in the Cold. She says that one of the officers had put Karen in the back of the cruiser and she was sitting there with her and Carrie came over. She grabbed their hands and asked them to pray. She said that she noticed blood on her hands and Jen said that they had to tell her that it was John's blood. Jen said that Karen said, "What if he's dead? Promise me you'll take care of the kids. Somebody's got to take care of the kids." And then they prayed. She said at the end, they were moving John and Karen told Carrie to go over and look and she was yelling, "They're working on him." She said that that's when Karen grabbed her hands and was shaking her and told her to Google how long does it take to die in the cold. Jen said that her hands were frozen, and in one sentence she said that she had her phone out, in another she said that she got her phone out, but we know that she had called Brian Albert less than a minute before the search, so I'm assuming that she already had it out. But she said that she Googled how long to die in the cold multiple times because as she was typing it, she didn't know what was coming up and Karen was screaming and her hands were shaking. She said that she doesn't remember if she got an answer because she said that they were moving John, so then she and Karen started moving. I keep a very detailed timeline of everything that has been testified to or everything that has been in reports on this case. So when I put this in my timeline, I had questions about it. Jen said that she was Googling this as they were moving John, and she stopped looking for the answer because they were moving him. But John had already been moved for about 10 minutes by this time. I double-checked, and the stretcher came and loaded John on the dash cam, and they walk him away at 6:14, straight to the ambulance to try to warm him up. That's a full 10 minutes before the search where she says that she stops because they're moving him. Flamati testified on day 3 that they moved John into the ambulance and shut the doors to warm him up. He lists off all these things that they then did. They tried to open his airway, they suctioned fluid, etc., and then they intubated him at 6:22. All of these things happened inside the ambulance, not while they were moving him. Transport time was at 6:27, 3 minutes after the final search, so that doesn't make sense either. So Jen's story of Googling how long to die in the cold isn't possible based on the timing. It's another detail that seems very small until you put it together with everything else that we know. And then it kind of blows that explanation. Maybe this is another thing that they'll eventually clear up. Hopefully. Jen said that one of the officers asked her to go in the house and wake up her sister and brother-in-law. She said that she had called Nicole, and we've heard about those two calls. She maintains that Nicole did not answer them, and Nicole said the same thing. Nicole said, "I did not answer those calls." She went into the house and went up to their bedroom, went busting through the door. Jackson asked Jen about seeing Chloe that morning, and he said that when Jen went busting into her sister's room to wake them up, she was frantic and distraught and loud and everything was chaotic. And he asks her, "With all that going on, you don't remember a 70-pound German Shepherd having any kind of reaction?" And Jen says she has no memory of seeing that dog. Jen said that she was upset and distraught, and she told Brian and Nicole when she went in to wake them up that John was dead. She said that Brian's response was, "Who's John?" Shortly after that, she went downstairs and Brian and Nicole came down after. Link was already downstairs, and Jen had called Matt at some point and told him to come over as well. When Matt arrived, he saw Carrie Roberts, who he says he knew but not very well. Carrie told him that she was about to drop Karen off at the house and then go pick up John's parents in Braintree. When Matt walked in the house, he said it was just Link in there at that time. He said that another officer came in a little bit after that. I'm not going to rehash all the details of who was there for this and Julie bringing donuts and all of that. No sense in beating a dead horse. We've been through that in previous episodes. Jen said that while Karen was in the ambulance for the Section 12, that Karen kept repeating herself and asking if John was dead. She said that Then she brought up the kids and she asked if Jen would visit her. And Jen said that she told her yes. Proctor and Buchanan came to the McCabe's house later. Jen said that she was all shaken up and nervous and overwhelmed, and she wanted support, so she told Brian Albert to come over because he's like a big brother to her. So he was there, and he talked to the troopers as well. Jackson asked if this was because Brian wanted to make sure that he was there while they talked to the police, but Jen says it was just for support. Matt and Jen both say that they had never met Proctor, and Matt said that when they came to talk to Jen, he went upstairs, and when they interviewed him, she went upstairs or to the kids' room. He said they both stayed upstairs when the troopers were talking to Brian and Nicole. Jen and Carrie had only met one time before, but they were together and talked more often after John's death. On February 1st, the Tuesday following John's death, Jen said that officers came to her house and Carrie happened to be there, so they talked to her as well. Jen was in the next room and could hear some of what was being said, and she kind of went back and forth with Jackson on just how much she could hear and if she was eavesdropping. There's a group text with Jen, Matt, Brian, and Nicole, where Jackson said that Jen was reporting back to them what was being heard, including a text that says, quote, "She's telling them everything," end quote, in all caps with two exclamation points. And then she said, "all the stuff." Now, when this is brought up, Jen discusses two separate interviews that were done with Carrie Roberts while she was present. One was at her house and one was on the phone. Jen tells Alan Jackson what she means when she says that Carrie was telling them everything.
I said, "She's telling them everything."
I know.
Because Carrie is an extremely blunt person, and she was giving personal feelings about the situation, and I was horrified by it.
To the police.
To the police.
And you're listening.
I heard a statement she said that horrified me.
And then you're reporting it back to the group, weren't you?
That one thing she stated, I reported back to the group, yes.
So you're listening in on a police interview, correct?
It was a phone call.
One side of it, right?
It was a phone call.
You're listening in on a police interview, one side of it, correct?
Correct.
You're eavesdropping on that interview, correct?
I'm sitting with her and she's taking the call.
And then you're reporting that interview back, or her success in that interview, in your mind, back to the group involving Brian Albert, Nicole Albert, and Matt McCabe. Isn't that what you're doing?
Objection.
I'll allow it.
I absolutely not. That is not how it went. I was horrified because Carrie's a blunt person, not like me. And she had made a comment about Miss Reed and Mr. O'Keefe's relationship. And I was shocked and horrified that she said it the way that she did.
You're so shocked and horrified.
I said, "Oh my God, she's telling them everything." Yes.
You decided it was so important that you needed to report that back to Brian Albert and his friends.
I was horrified.
So you reported that back?
Yes, I said she told them everything.
Later, during redirect, Lally asked Jen, what was it that was so horrifying?
So basically, Carrie is a talker, and once she started...
I think just focus on what she said.
Okay. She said something like, "John really loved Amy, and in my eyes, Karen was just a babysitter with benefits."
Carrie didn't testify to saying this, so we don't know exactly what was said or if anything was heard, right or wrong, or whatever. Goodness knows, statements in this case are all conflicting, so we know that we can't really rely on witness testimony. But this comment didn't seem horrifying. It seemed really petty and mean girl. We hear more about the group text happening while Carrie is talking to police, including Matt saying this girl could write a book nonstop, and Jen saying, "I love it," and she's telling them everything. Jackson and Jen McCabe go back and forth about how she heard these things when she testified before that she couldn't hear anything, and he asks her about her story changing. Jen said, "There is no story."
There is no story. There's facts and truth on this side. There's no story. The story that you've created is not the truth.
Did I create? I hit him, or did you?
That's fact.
A fact that conveniently you didn't mention in your report to Lank, Proctor, grand jury,
right? That kind of fact.
Objection.
Is that right?
That is the fact I mentioned. So in some reports, it's there.
The group text is also brought up during the testimony with Matt McCabe. Yannetti brings up the group text and says that 3 days after John's passing, on February 1st, Matt was driving by Fairview Road and he texted the group chat, "Troopers back out front, like in front of Asian House," referencing the neighbors of the Alberts who are of Asian descent. Brian Albert responded by asking, "Right now?" And Matt said yes, and that he was going to go back and try to get a picture to send them. Yannetti brings this up and asks Matt if he was trying to monitor what was going on for them, since the police were out there looking. There's also group texts that are referenced where Julie said Channel 4 News was in D&E Pizza.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then you then texted your wife, Brian Albert, and Nicole Albert, quote, "Tell them the guy never went in the house," correct?
Yeah, that's part of the same text. Yes.
Mr. McCabe, who was the guy that you were referring to? Does he have a name?
That would be John O'Keefe.
When you told the group to tell them the guy never went in the house, that was you talking about how you should all get your stories straight, correct?
No.
You would agree with me that your stories are all straight in terms of the guy never went in the house, correct?
Objection.
Can you answer that?
John never went in the house. It's not a story, it's a fact.
Matt McCabe explains who them is.
The them was Channel 4 went into D&E.
You done with your answer?
Yeah, you just asked me who them was.
And the answer is you were instructing people on the group chat to tell Channel 4 that the guy never went in the house, correct?
Yes, this was on February 1st. As I said, none of us in the house had any idea what happened to John O'Keefe. So we instructed, I was saying, we don't know what happened. He never came in the house.
All right,
That's what my statement was.
When bringing this up with Jen McCabe, attorney Alan Jackson asks if she considers this collusion. She said that that's not how she looks at this. You know, between Brian Albert saying John who, when Jen went up there and told them that John was dead, and Matt McCabe's text that said, "Tell them the guy never came in the house," it kind of paints a different picture than this close friendship that has been portrayed by some in the media. They seem to put a lot of distance between themselves and Officer O'Keefe in some of these situations. A text between Nicole and Jen is also brought up where Nicole said on January 29th, "We'll get more info tomorrow. Don't want to text about it." Jen responded to that text and said, "Right?" Jackson asks what this is in reference to and why they don't want to text about it. Jen said that it's because her children look at her phone and Nicole's children look at Nicole's phone. She said that they were working with police and sharing information and everything that had happened and didn't want it to leave their little circle. They didn't want it out there. Jackson then brings up that the very next day, after the text about how they will know more tomorrow, Jen and Carrie Roberts went to Sergeant Link's house and were there for 45 minutes and never reported it to anyone. In fact, it wasn't actually talked about until Jen's meeting with the DA before the trial. She said that when they asked if she went to Lanks because they found out about that on a report, that she said, "Oh, yeah, I didn't think much about it." She said that she was just with Carrie and was only talking to Lanks' wife, and that's why she didn't think much about it. Here's Jen explaining this.
And during that half hour to an hour, did they go over with you what they expected your testimony to be?
They never spoke about what they expected my testimony to be. They just showed me some pictures that might be shown. I listened to the 911.
What pictures?
Just of the house and how I'd be asked to, you know, show. Okay, we're going to put a picture of the house and they'll have a laser.
Okay, when we started this conversation, it was because you said, in answer to my question, was anything ever brought up to you about this meeting at Lank's house?
Mm-hmm.
You said yes.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they did talk to you about your testimony. It wasn't just about the process, correct?
I was told, I asked what discovery had been turned in regard to me.
So you wanted to prepare to make sure that you knew what you might be asked on cross-examination, correct?
I wanted to know what was coming, yes.
And you knew that one of the things was coming after this meet. Well, let me ask it a different way. During this meeting, did Mr. Lowley tell you one of the things that's going to be coming is you had an off-the-books meeting at Lank's house for 45 minutes? Did he tell you that?
No, that's not how I was told.
Did he tell you that the defense had uncovered a report that established that you were actually at Michael Lank's house for 45 minutes that had never been reported to the defense or the prosecution before the phone extraction had been done? Did he tell you that?
I was told, I was asked, oh, were you at Michael Lank's on the 30th?
So you've had a lot of time to come up with a story about why you were at Michael Lank's, correct?
Objection.
I'll allow it.
I didn't need time to make up a story because I have the truth of why we went.
And the truth, according to you, is you pulled up at Michael Lank's house. The first responding officer and friends of the Alberts had a meeting with him the next day that was never reported to anybody for any purpose.
I
just met with his wife out in the car while the car was running for 45 minutes to an hour. That's your story.
It's not a story. It's the truth. Carrie dropped her daughter off. The wife came out. Carrie is a talker. They started talking. A tragedy had happened the day before.
It is interesting, would you not agree, that the day before you had this off-the-books meeting at Michael Lank's house, Nicole Albert says, we'll get more info tomorrow, meaning the very day you show up at Lank's house.
Again, I never spoke with Mike Lank at his house. It was not an off-the-books meeting. It was Carrie dropping her daughter at one of her good friend's house, whose husband happens to be a Canton cop. That is what it is. That is the truth.
Jackson said that the same report that shows that she went to Lank's house shows that she went by 34 Fairview first, picking up Nicole Albert. Jen said that she didn't go by to pick up Nicole. She just may have slowed down as she passed, but she said that she has to pass by there to go to Lank's house. She also said that she never went inside, other than maybe to use the bathroom. The meetings don't end with Jen going to Lank's house, though. On her third day on the stand, during cross-examination, Alan Jackson asked Jen what other home visits she's had with officers involved in this case, aside from Lank. Jen says, Kevin Albert, and Jackson says, who else? That's when the jury hears for the first time that Jen McCabe also went to the home of the lead investigator, Michael Proctor, in September of last year. Jen says that she didn't go there to see Michael Proctor. She went there, again, to see his wife, same with Lank, who she said she met the month or two before that. Now, this is obviously a really bad look. When a key witness in a case is at the home of the lead investigator and the only reason it's known is because someone saw her car there, that doesn't look good. It actually looks really bad. Jen gets very defensive about this, and she says that the reason that she went is because of the harassment.
Why'd you go to Michael Proctor's house in September of 2023?
I met Elizabeth Proctor in approximately July or August of 2023. We are two mothers that are being viciously terrorized and harassed by social media. Things that were stated in this courtroom and allegations that were made have torn our lives upside down. We receive hate letters, letters saying that they hope things.
Why? I know you want to give a narrative.
She gets to answer this, Mr. Jackson. The door's open.
Your Honor, if she could answer the question why she went to the house as opposed to the narrative behind her motivation.
It sounds to me like she's explaining why she went to the house.
Okay.
The door was open, Mr. Jackson.
Go ahead.
We receive letters, we receive emails, we receive calls, people drive by our house. There was a rolling rally outside of my house where people just screamed at us. They take pictures of our children. They took a picture of my daughter and put semen on it and said property of some named blogger that I think the defense is very familiar with. So that is why myself and Elizabeth Proctor got together. Michael Proctor was not home. We are two mothers trying to get through the unthinkable together.
So you were upset about the public outrage concerning your family's involvement in the death of John O'Keefe.
I was outraged because I am a state witness that is being tortured because of lies.
Because of public outrage concerning your family's involvement in the death of a police officer, correct?
No, it's a social media witch hunt.
I see. So you decided that the best way for you to address that angst that you were feeling is to go to the lead investigator's home, personal home, in this case, correct?
I went to visit Elizabeth Proctor. So Michael Proctor was not home.
The harassment is something that Jen has made sure to inform the jury of. This isn't the first time that she's brought it up. She also brought it up when she was asked about talking to Chris and Julie Albert about the case.
Do I speak to Chris and Julie Albert?
Have you spoken to them about these events between then and now?
About this case? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, Ms. McCabe, I'm asking about this case.
Of course I speak to them all the time about the vicious harassment we are all receiving.
That wasn't my question. My question was, did you talk to them about this case, Ms. McCabe?
Yes.
I realize you want to give additional answers and editorialize. I'm asking you very specific questions.
Mm-hmm.
Objection.
Jackson continued to push after this, asking Jen if they had compared notes and observations on what the story is.
They told you their observations of the night, correct?
Correct.
So y'all have compared and contrasted your perspectives of what happened that night. Correct?
We've tried to figure out what happened to John, our friend.
And you've talked to them extensively about your observations and what your story or your version is. Is that right?
To be honest, not extensively. Speaking about it is very painful and difficult.
What does extensively mean? More than twice?
Well, you tell me.
I'm asking the questions, Ms. McCabe. That's how this works.
I understand, but extensively would mean almost every day.
Do you talk to them almost every day?
I do, but not about the case.
Subjects about this case come up every day?
The harassment of the case does, yes.
What about the specific facts of the case?
No, it's the facts aren't spoken as much as the vicious harassment is spoken about.
So you've told them your version of the events, correct? And they've told you their version of the events.
Correct.
And remind me, Chris and Julie Albert are, in fact, Colin's parents.
Correct.
She also mentions the harassment when she tells the jury that she is a witness. She is not on trial.
And you testified about certain incidents of harassment that you had undergone, as well as Mrs. Proctor. Is that correct?
Correct.
How long had that been going on for at that point?
At that point, it started in April, and now I believe I went over there in September.
And what, if anything, was the frequency of the harassment? Was it sporadic, or how often were you experiencing that?
Daily, sometimes hourly.
And in addition to what you've already testified, what, if any, other incidents do you recall specifically involving either you or your children or your home?
People come by my house, they take video, they scream, they've gone to my child's sporting events, and called me names. They've written letters to my daughter's colleges and said that they shouldn't allow them to play. And then they've, attached these horrific articles that have been complete lies about all of us. They send me Facebook messages, they call my phone my home phone and cell phone all hours of the night. They tell me to kill myself. They tell me I'm a terrible mother. They harass my children. My daughter testified here the other day. We didn't even get out of the building, and people were, you know, saying horrendous things, that she's a liar. You know, your mother should die. It's just, it's unimaginable what my entire family is going through. I go to the beach, they take pictures, they post it, they threaten that there are eyes everywhere. I'll never be able to live a normal life again. I am a witness. That's all I am. I am not on trial. I am a witness. And these people are terrorizing me.
Sustained as to that part. I'll strike that part. Everything else is sustained.
Okay.
And again, giving some specifics.
Now, you did have some conversations with Trooper Proctor following this day and around let me ask you this. You testified a bit about a rolling round. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can you describe to the jury sort of what that was or what occurred on that day?
So that day in July, a group got together under one blogger, and they all met and they decided to go to different houses. So Michael Proctor had been made aware of what was happening. So he had reached out to tell me, you know, what was going to be happening and how they had set up some cameras. It was a Saturday. I had just come home from vacation with my children and my husband. Mrs. O'Keefe picked up my two younger children and brought them out with her so they wouldn't be home for this. And my two older children and my husband were in the house while about, I don't know, 50 to 75 people came to my house. They screamed, they yelled, "There's a murderer." They just caused an absolute ruckus outside.
And during the final moments of Jen's testimony, when Alan Jackson is doing a recross and asking her questions, he brings up something that Jen had said about the harassment that she keeps mentioning starting around April of 2023. He compares that time frame to the time frame that her story changed from all of the previous reports and grand jury testimony. The utter frustration that they have with each other at this point is evident in this exchange.
You know that you started suffering this harassment that you'd claimed is awful and terrible, etc., around April of 2023. Is that right?
I didn't claim it's awful. It is awful.
Okay, I'm sure it is awful, Ms. McCabe. I'm sure it's terrible.
It is.
I'm sure it sucks to be harassed.
It really does.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
Objection, Your Honor.
All right, so that's sustained, and I'll strike it. Go ahead and ask a question, Mr. Jackson.
You were upset by April of 2023 that there was public outrage about your family being involved in the death of John O'Keefe. That's what you were upset about, correct?
I was upset that we as witnesses were being harassed.
You were upset about public outrage concerning this case, correct?
Objection.
Sustained. That was answered. Next question.
And two months later, in June of 2023, for the first time, you testified at another proceeding, and lo and behold, you attributed the words, "I hid it," to my client, right?
Objection.
So ask that without the objectionable phrase.
2 months later, at another proceeding, in June of 2023, you attributed the statement, "I hid him," to my client for the first time under oath, correct?
Under oath, correct.
Next up, we hear from Carrie Roberts, right after this. Carrie Roberts has known John O'Keefe since high school, and that's how she met Karen Reed. She said that on the morning of January 29th, she woke up to a phone call from Karen at 5 a.m. on the dot.
I answered the phone, and she said, "John's dead. Carrie, Carrie, Carrie." And then she hung up.
She said that she didn't even get a chance to say anything back, and Karen was so loud that it woke up her husband, Kurt, who we actually heard from on one of the earlier days of testimony. Carrie said that she tried to call back a few times to find out what's going on, and finally, Karen called her back and said that she's afraid that John might be dead. He might have been hit by a plow. He didn't come home last night. She said that she wasn't supposed to stay in Canton and that John would never leave Kaylee alone, so something must have happened. Karen told her that she drank so much the night before that she doesn't remember anything, and she asked if she can come to her house to have Carrie drive her car. Carrie said that she told her that she needed to go home. She's going to get a DUI, and Carrie said that she would go look for John herself. Karen said that she was going to come to Carrie's house, and Carrie said, fine. She tried to call John with no answer, and she went and cleared her car off and waited for about 10 minutes, but Karen didn't show up. Carrie called the Canton non-emergency number while she was waiting to see if there were any accidents, and she called Good Samaritan Hospital to check. But then Karen called back and said that she was at Jen's house and Jen was going to drive her car. Carrie went to Jen's and met them there, and while on the way, she was on the phone and asking Karen if she had checked to see if John was passed out in the house somewhere. But Karen said that she didn't look. Carrie said that they looked while they were in the driveway at Karen's taillight.
At some point in the conversation, she said, what about my taillight? What about my taillight? And I looked, and there was a piece missing, but it was caked on with snow. You could tell there was a little black hole, but there was snow, like, caked on it, and it was a blizzard at this point.
This was in Jen's driveway, and Carrie said that they left there to go to John's. When they got there, we hear again how Carrie and Jen took their shoes off, and they looked around for John inside the house. When they saw John wasn't in the house, they headed toward Fairview Road. Carrie gave some of the details that Jen did about the ride there and how she said when Karen was trying to figure out where John was, she mentioned Bella's house. Karen said that Bella's mom never liked me. She also referenced a house being close by where someone lived that John used to date about 10 years before that, and Karen asked if he could possibly be there. When they pulled up and Karen saw John, Carrie said she jumped out and ran over to what Carrie referred to as a mound that she then realized was John. When they play the dash cam video showing where Carrie's car was parked, she cries on the stand as she's watching and listening. Carrie described seeing John in the snow, and she said that one eye looked like a golf ball. He was bleeding from the back of his head, and he had 3 to 4 inches of snow on his body. She said that Karen was running around screaming, "Did I hit him? Did I hit him?" and asking if he was dead. Carrie said while they were trying to do CPR, she was doing chest compressions and first responders arrived less than 10 minutes later and they took over working on him. Karen was running around frantic and she said that Jen was over somewhere by the car. She said when the paramedics took John away on the stretcher, she saw where he had been laying, that there was grass underneath him and his phone. She picked up his phone and put it in her pocket. She later gave it to one of the first responders, but can't remember which one, and she can't remember if it was a police officer or an EMT. We still aren't sure about that since none of them testified to receiving the phone. Carrie said at some point, Officer Good told Karen that she needed to calm down, and Karen and Jen were put in the back of a cruiser to warm up. Carrie stood outside of the ambulance because she said that she could see through the ambulance window that they were working on him. She said Karen yelled in her face at one point and asked if they were working on John and if he was dead. Carrie said that she told her that they're working on him and that they wouldn't be working on him if he was dead. She said that Karen grabbed their hands and had them pray. The ambulance pulled away and Jen went up to the house and Carrie called John's parents. Carrie then explains the conversation that she had with Karen while they were leaving Fairview.
As we were leaving, she was saying to me, if anything happens to John, I'm going to kill myself. You need to take care of these kids.
And how did you respond to that?
He's not going to die. No one's doing anything of that nature. Or something of that nature, I said.
Carrie said that she barely made it to Dedham Street when Officer Good called and said to bring Karen back because her parents have called in saying that she's suicidal and they wanted her to be sectioned. Carrie said that Karen talked to her mom on the phone, and at one point, Carrie spoke to Karen's mom as well and told her that she's going to the hospital. Karen's mom asked Carrie not to give Karen her purse. She said that she has medication in there and she doesn't want Karen to take it. When they got back, Karen walked to the ambulance, and one of the first responders came to get Karen's phone from Carrie, who still had it where she was talking to Karen's mom. Carrie left to go pick up John's parents and drive them to the hospital. When she arrived, she said John's brother Paul was already there, and John's cousin, who works at the hospital on the switchboard, they had been talking to her on the way there, and she actually came out to greet the family when they arrived. She asked John's cousin to take her to the bathroom so that she could clean up because she had blood on her hands. After that, she went to the chapel and said a prayer. John's family was called in by the doctor as Carrie was coming out of the chapel, and she waited in the waiting area for them to come back out.
Mrs. O'Keefe came out and told me John was gone. And then she asked if I wanted to see him. So I did, because I figured it would be better than when I last saw him. Maybe he was cleaned up, or, but it was not. It was worse.
Sorry, ma'am. Like, as far as to say that it was worse, it happened to a room where John was, is that right?
Yes.
And what did you see?
He was in a neck brace, and both eyes were huge. Whereas when I found him, it was only one, but they were like black, almost like filled with, I don't know, blood or fluid. They were huge.
Beyond what you observed in his eyes, what, if anything else, did you see on John's body as you were?
He had scratches on his arm.
Do you recall which arm it was?
His right arm.
Carrie took John's parents back to John's house before going home. She said she only talked to Proctor one time, and that was at Jen's house. Troopers took her phone at that time, and she said that they had it for about 7 or 8 hours. Carrie is asked about Lank, and she says that her daughter and Lank's daughter are friends, and she's friends with Lank's wife. She gives the same story that Jen did about dropping off her daughter there and talking to Lank's wife, and said that they talked for about 45 minutes. The defense declined a cross-examination for Carrie Roberts. We'll be right back. We've heard about the Aruba trip around New Year's Eve when there was an argument between Karen and John because she thought that John was making out with someone else in the hotel lobby. Laura Sullivan and her sister Marietta Sullivan took the stand on day 16 to testify about this. First on the stand was Laura Sullivan. Laura met John O'Keefe in a bar in 2013 and then began dating John's best friend, Pat. Shortly after that, she got pregnant with Pat's baby, but Pat tragically took his own life later that year. Laura said that she had a conversation with Pat one day that just didn't feel right, so she called John to go check on him. John left his nephew's birthday party, immediately springing into action.
So, in November of 2013, I was on a work trip, and I had not had the best conversation with Pat. It was kind of, it just didn't feel right. And I called John and said, you need to go find him. I can't get a hold of him. He won't answer his phone. And so John left his nephew's birthday party and called a bunch of people on the way. And ultimately, Pat was found in the basement of his house. And John was there immediately following, but he was the one that found people to go find Pat. Immediately following that, John never really left my side, you know, as a support system.
Laura goes on to describe how John stepped up for her and her son, and once again, we're given a glimpse into what an amazing man Officer John O'Keefe was.
It was his birthday, December of 2013, and we went to the Playwright, which is where we had all met. And I gave him a card, and I asked him to be Ben's godfather, and he said yes.
And in relation to your son, was Mr. O'Keefe, was John involved in your son's life?
Yes, very much so.
And how so?
He was every birthday, Christmas. He was always in contact. He was the first person in my delivery room after I gave birth. He was a constant. He was a connection to Pat, and always making sure that, you know, Ben was taken care of, in the sense of you know, being there to tell stories or what have you, from his relationship with Pat.
Laura's family has also got to know John. Here's her younger sister, Marietta.
He was a very, very dear family friend. He was very close to my sister, subsequently became very close to me and my family as a result. And he was my nephew's godfather.
Marietta goes on to say that she looked at John as a big brother.
He was similar to a big brother to me. He was somebody who was there for my sister during her darkest times. So I really respected him for that. But he was a big brother and a family friend.
Laura and her boyfriend, Josh, have been going to Aruba for years. In 2021, they decided to bring their children, Laura's son, as well as Josh's two children, since they had never taken them before. Since it was post-COVID, she said that everyone was in that kind of stir-crazy mode from being stuck inside, so a group of friends jumped on board to go as well. The trip went from being the five of them to a group of about 60 people. They bought up timeshare weeks that weren't being used by the owners and were able to get somewhere around 20 rooms for their group. Laura said that in the summer of 2021, John had said that he was interested in taking the trip with Karen and his niece and nephew. Laura said that she talked to John and could hear Karen asking questions, so he put Karen on the phone so that Laura could answer whatever questions she had. She said that Karen wanted two rooms, and she needed her own bathroom and space, so Laura was able to put her in touch with someone. They were able to get the second room, but they were on opposite sides of the hotel from each other, about 200 steps away. I know that Karen had some health issues, and I know that there were also issues with her and John not being able to spend much time alone together, so paying for an extra room isn't really too surprising here. Laura said that they arrived on the 30th, and so did John, Karen, and the kids, but the rest of the group arrived the following day. Laura said that when John texted her to let her know that they had arrived, she and her son ran to the hotel lobby to see him. Laura said that she had never met Karen, but while she was in the lobby, she saw a woman banging on the window and saw that Kaylee, John's niece, was with her, so she knew that it must be her. She said that Karen came around and gave her a big hug and told her that it was nice to meet her and said that she had heard so much about her and recognized her from pictures. Laura said that she had some friends who had been in town since Christmas and they planned on going to dinner that night for Josh's birthday. The friends had a 17-year-old daughter who was going to be keeping the kids that night while they all went to dinner and had drinks. Laura said that when the bill came at the end of the night, Karen had already paid for it for everyone.
The entire table was kind of taken aback, you know, said it wasn't necessary, wanted to Venmo or give cash or something along those lines, and she declined, saying that she was honored to be there and wanted to pay for it.
The next day, on the 31st, the rest of the group was set to arrive in Aruba, including Marietta. Laura thought that she got to the hotel no later than 1, but Marietta said that their flight landed at 3:30, so I'm not sure exactly what time she got there, but it was sometime in the afternoon. Laura said that John had mentioned wanting to spend the day just hanging out in the pool bar and watching the Alabama game. She saw him at the pool bar watching the game with her boyfriend Josh, and she remembers seeing the kids and Karen, but can't remember if they spoke or not. Marietta said that after they checked into their room, they went to the pool bar because happy hour was starting, and she saw John there in his Bama hat, excited to watch the game. That night, a group of people went to dinner, though John and Karen stayed behind. And when the group returned back to the hotel, they planned on going to the pool so the kids could swim, and they would ring in the new year at the pool bar watching it on TV and watching the fireworks. Marietta had gone upstairs, and she said that when she came back down, as she's getting off the elevator, she saw John coming into the lobby from the outside pool bar area, and she said that he seemed to be stumbling and kind of glassy-eyed. By this time, it's after 9 p.m., and the Bama game that day was at 3:30. It was a CFP semifinal game, and Bama beat the Cincinnati Bearcats 27-6, so from the sound of it, John probably enjoyed the game and celebrating his team's big win at the pool bar. Marietta said that she went up to John and gave him a big hug, and he seemed like he was looking around trying to get to the room. She said that he pointed towards some rooms to the right and said that he was going there, so she said that she stepped back and guided him toward that area that he was going.
So I pointed in that direction. He walked off. I continued out to the pool bar. when I heard very loudly his name screamed across the lobby very angrily, and it made me stop in my tracks.
And when you stop in your tracks, what happened?
I started to turn around to come back in. So once you go out to the pool bar, you kind of go around a corner and you go out of view. So I turned around to go back in. As I'm going back in, I hear someone yell, "Who the fuck was that?" And as I come around the corner, I see Mr. O'Keefe walking toward a woman. He said, "Calm down. That's Laura's little sister."
And what happened then?
When I came back around the corner, I said, after Mr. O'Keefe said, "Calm down, that's Laura's little sister," I said, "Hi, nice to meet you." That's when Ms. Reed's head snapped up, and she very loudly told me to go fuck myself across the lobby. And I said, "Yeah, fuck you too," and walked away.
Marietta went outside to the pool bar and approached her sister Laura about the confrontation that she had just had.
I went straight up to my older sister, Laura, who was out to dinner with the couple the night before. I went up to her and I looked at her and I said, "John O'Keefe's girlfriend?" And she looked at me and said, "Karen?" And I said, "Yeah, you guys like her?" She said, "Yeah, she's okay." And I said, "Well, she sucks."
Laura said that John came back out to the pool area about 20 minutes later, and she asked him about what had happened.
I turned around and I was pretty shocked to see him. I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Nothing." I said, "Did Etta and Karen have words?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, that's not what Etta said." And I asked him if everything was okay. And at that time, his phone was lighting up, and it looked like calls and texts. And it said Karen on his phone.
After you make that observation, what did you say to John?
I asked him if he needed to take it, and he said, "Yes, she's crazy. I got to take care of this."
Laura said that's the last time that she saw John on New Year's Eve. The following day, January 1st, Laura said that she saw the kids but never did see John or Karen. On the 2nd, the group rented a bunch of cabanas. When John hadn't showed up, Laura said that she texted him to ask if he was coming. She said that John told her that Karen thought that he made out with Marietta, and she said that she was shocked to hear that. She said that she went and asked her sister, who responded, "Absolutely not." Eventually, she said that John and Karen did join the group, and she remembers Karen floating in the ocean for most of the day, while John kind of bounced around to the different cabanas talking to everyone. She said that he didn't seem like himself at all, and he seemed kind of distant. Later that day, Laura said that she saw John in the pool area and asked him if he was happy. She said that he kind of just shrugged it off, and he really didn't want to talk about it. The group had plans on another day to go on a boat, and they arranged a bus to take them to the boat from the hotel. Laura said that John didn't show up for the bus and wasn't answering her calls or texts. He finally messaged her right before their boat was about to leave, letting her know that they weren't going to be able to make it because the kids slept late. Laura said that Karen and John ended up leaving a day or two early so that the kids could get back to school, and she describes her interaction with them the night before they left. Laura and some friends were sitting at the bar when John and Karen walked up.
What, if any, conversation did you have with either Mr. O'Keefe or the defendant at that time?
Karen grabbed me and she said, "Hey, I'm sorry. I thought I saw something that I didn't. And I would like to pay for some of your sister's room."
And how did you respond to that?
I said, "It's absolutely not necessary. Just an apology will do."
And did she persist in wanting to pay for the room?
She did.
And how so?
She just said, I will apologize, but something along the lines of, you know, I want to pay for some of her room. Can I just have her room number? I don't remember if I gave her the room number or not. I don't really know.
Laura saw them one last time on January 5th, the day they were leaving. And she said that John came up and gave her a big hug and said it was a great trip. That's the last time that Laura ever physically saw John O'Keefe. When Laura heard that he had passed, she said that she texted Kaylee and Karen. When she asked Karen what had happened, she said that Karen told her that they had gone to a party, but she didn't go in, and she went home, and that they had found John in the snow the next morning. During the testimony of both Laura and Marietta Sullivan, the judge instructed the jury that the statements made are only to be used in establishing John O'Keefe's state of mind and Karen Reed's motive or intent on January 28th and 29th. Part of the Commonwealth's theory seems to be that Karen was so angry about the night in Aruba where she thought that John was kissing another woman that it gave her motive to kill him a month later. During the cross-examination of each witness, David Unetti asked only three questions.
Good afternoon, Ms. Sullivan.
Good afternoon.
Fair to say that you were not at the Waterfall Bar and Grill on January 28th of 2022 in Canton?
I was not.
You were not at 34 Fairview Road in Canton on January 29th, correct?
I was not.
Yet Trooper Proctor drove all the way to Pembroke to interview you on February 8th of 2022. Did he not?
He did.
Nothing further.
Though this was only three questions, it was a brilliant cross-examination by attorney David Unetti. He establishes that neither Sullivan sister was present at Waterfall, the last place that the witnesses say that they saw John O'Keefe alive, and neither were present at Fairview Road, the place where John was ultimately found the next morning. Yet Trooper Proctor drove 45 minutes away to interview them in Pembroke, Massachusetts, to ask them about an argument between Karen and John a month earlier. At this point, let's think about who the jury has heard from and when they said they were interviewed. Heather Maxson, who is the only witness to place John O'Keefe inside Karen's SUV that night, wasn't interviewed for 19 months. Ricky D'Antano, who was parked directly behind Karen just minutes before the prosecution says that she ran over John O'Keefe, wasn't interviewed by state police for 21 months. Sarah Levinson left the house that night an hour after they said John was killed, going right past where he was found the next morning, but she wasn't interviewed for 9 months. Julie Nagel, who testified to seeing a black blob in the yard, wasn't interviewed for 9 months. Brian Albert Jr. testified to looking out the window and said that he saw Karen's car move multiple times, but he wasn't interviewed for 18 months. Caitlin Albert rode right by where John was found, maybe an hour and a half after they said that he was killed, and she wasn't interviewed for 16 months. Her boyfriend, Tristan, who came to pick her up, passed by the area where they said John was laying twice that night, but wasn't even interviewed until a week before he testified in this trial. Colin Albert was in the house and estimated to be leaving around the same time that John and Karen were showing up, and he wasn't interviewed for 18 months. Allie McCabe was at the house to pick Colin up, and she wasn't interviewed for 19 months. Lucky the snowplow driver literally passed by the house multiple times that night and saw a Ford Edge parked right by where John O'Keefe's body was found. And he wasn't even interviewed for 21 months. But thank goodness that because of Proctor's investigation, they knew within a week that Karen yelled at Laura Sullivan's little sister that one time in Aruba after buying everyone's dinner and not letting them Venmo her for it. This is infuriating. Think about all of the inconsistencies in the statements that we've heard. Think about the problems with people not remembering things and giving different details, both big and small. And think about who could have maybe seen something or remembered something if they had been interviewed in a timely manner. But they weren't. Proctor wasn't concerned with getting any information from the witnesses who were actually there while it was fresh in their minds. He was already focusing on building a motive for Karen Reed. Trial isn't even close to being over. We still have so much more to hear. Are they going to be able to prove that Karen did this? We don't know that yet. But with all of the witnesses who were there, and any little detail that may have made a difference in proving it one way or the other, why would you not try? How can you skip talking to some of the key people who were actually there and think that it's more important to track down these two sisters who can give him the gossip about a drunken argument in Aruba a month before? Those three questions asked by David Unetti highlight exactly where the priority was in the investigation. Not on finding out anything and everything that could give any information to help figure out or prove exactly what happened, but on building a motive for Karen Reed. This was a really long episode, but we had a lot to get in. On the next episode, we will dive into the testimony of Brian Higgins. That's one we've all been waiting on. Plus, John's niece and nephew took the stand. And we will hear from the ER doctor. We'll hear about the blood alcohol testing and conversions for Karen Reed, the public works employee who is in charge of the snowplow drivers, and the man in charge of the library footage that we've heard so much about. Is it really missing those 2 critical minutes that the defense said should show Karen driving by? All of that on the next episode of 13th Juror Podcast. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.